Yesterday, Kansas City learned that Sailor Jack's in the heart of Westport had closed for good, effective immediately. The news came from a note posted to the door, but perhaps more shocking to longtime Westport regulars was something else in that note. McCoy's Public House, owned by the same folks as Sailor Jack's, will close its doors at the end of this month, too. McCoy's has been around for more than two decades. It's been a place for Monday night burgers and beers, spring afternoons on the patio, business lunches that aren't too fussy, and sure, we will all miss those things. But there's something else, too. Questions about whether this marks a milestone of change in Westport. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and you can call 816-235-2888 if losing McCoy's means something to you. Have you noticed Westport changing? Does this feel like a part of that? 816-235-2888. Share your thoughts. My first guest was with McCoy's from the beginning, Paul Genez. He helped open the place, worked there for 10 years, and then consulted on the other concepts in what ultimately became a restaurant group. But we'll get there. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
You and your friends must be raising a lot of toasts right now. People are taking this hard.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, for 21 years, Mark and James with Beer KC have given a lot of people, not only the community, a great place to go eat and have fun and celebrate, but they've had hundreds and hundreds of employees who have been able to take care of themselves, help take care of their families through McCoy's.
How would you describe the appeal of McCoy's?
You know, it very much relaxed neighborhood feel. People felt very, very comfortable in the big booth there. And of course, when you're brewing craft beer and you smell that and you walk in the door, it smells like you're brewing oatmeal. And so people felt very comfortable just walking in the door. And the staff was really very welcoming, very friendly and greeting. And it was just a great place for the neighborhood to come. I don't think before we went in there 21 years ago, there weren't a lot of restaurants there. There weren't a lot of dining destinations. So it was the first place for a lot of the people who lived in the neighborhood to come and actually relax and enjoy a dining destination.
That is probably hard for people to imagine if they're more familiar with Westport as it is now. But yeah, there was Jerusalem Cafe, there was Californo's, and beyond, there was a big, like, do you remember the place that was across? There was another giant place, but it was sort of short-lived. There wasn't a lot.
Oh, Mill Creek Brewery?
Yes, that one. But yeah, there was not a lot.
No, there wasn't. I mean, if you look back, it was 90% bars and clubs. And there was, well, there's always been Kelly's. Kelly's will be around forever, hopefully. But there was Blaney's. There was the Lone Star. There was the Shadow. There was Heartthrobs. There was the Fallout, XO, Lynn Dickey's. And all those places didn't serve food, with the exception of one or two that was some very stereotypical bar food.
For me, you know, McCoy's was one of the few places that just about everyone I knew liked going and felt comfortable going regardless of their type. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just had this welcoming vibe that was never trying too hard to be part of any trend.
Yeah, there isn't a whole lot of pretentious down from the owners to the employees there. And, you know, the craft brewing crowd, you've seen craft beer explode over the last 10, 15 years. And it's a real casual crowd that just enjoys hanging out and enjoys sharing a beer with each other and talking about the beer, but more about just being part of the local community.
That corner at Westport Road in Pennsylvania is just quintessential Westport. Can you talk to me about the location and how it's changed?
Yeah, absolutely. Before we were there, it was the Harris. Well, it was the Harris House for a long time, and then for about 2 years, it was Westport Brewing Company. And it's kind of funny because there was just so much night traffic down there before we opened, and that's all it was. But once we opened and a few other dining spots started opening, there were also a lot of retail shops at the time. So it was a good vibe. You had a lot of foot traffic down there, a lot of people shopping, and then it became an eating destination. So you had this constant day, night, afternoon, happy hour business that really fed for people coming down to Westport. Before that, it was, let's go to the plaza and eat, and maybe we'll go have our drinks and party hard in Westport.
I spent a lot of time in Westport in the 1990s and early 2000s, and I worked at the Tivoli, so I have a little bit of that small business employee perspective from back then. And I always felt like there was a tension between the daytime weekday Westport and the nighttime weekend version of Westport. McCoy's was one of the few businesses that straddled that divide.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it had to do with having a great chef-driven menu, you know. It gave the daytime people a place to go. Before, the daytime crowds really felt like we are separated because when we get done with work at 5 o'clock, we're going to head back out to the suburbs or back out to the plaza or someplace where we can go eat. And it really bridged that gap where people during the day were interacting with locally owned restaurants down there because they had a place to go now.
Only a few businesses have really tried to walk that line, and a lot of those efforts just ended up people giving up. Like, the Tivoli tried, but ended up cutting out the late-night screenings. Broadway, the coffee shop, they ended up kind of changing their hours, cutting off a little bit earlier. But then there was you guys, and you guys actually, it seemed like, kind of became more of a late-night destination as time went on. How did that work?
You know, it's really kind of a funny story, a little twofold, because when we went down there, as I said, you know, being so much of a drinking destination, we're kind of taking a chance being a full-scale restaurant. And you normally want a full-scale restaurant to serve about 65% food, 35% liquor. And the first 6 months, 9 months we were open, it was largely liquor and a lot of late-night drinkers. And, of course, once the neighborhood saw the menu and tasted the menu, that flipped to where we were serving more food. However, and you'll see this, and they can talk to the restaurant business about this and late night business, but a lot of restaurants, when they're not getting late night business, will start closing earlier and earlier and earlier. And we actually had a discussion about that because our late night business was dropping off and dropping off and dropping off. And this was the second, third year, whatever we were open. And we decided, okay, we're going to take like a 90-day across the board, and we're going to stay until the bitter end every single night, whether we have business or not.
The bitter end as in bar closing time?
Yes. Back in the day. This was, you know, the first few years we were open. And it ended up that next year we were voted by the Pitch the best 3 a.m. bar. So I think that kind of shows you kind of train your guest on what you do, and they'll respond.
So do you think that tensions around Westport's identity have grown in the time that you've been just hanging out there, observing?
Well, you know, it's really been cyclical. You know, there's been good years, and then there's a year where there's a lot of complaints, whether it's the late night drunkenness, or whether it's too loud of music on patios, or whether it's violence. And it's very cyclical. You know, it'll be better for a few years, and then you'll have a rough year, and then it'll be better for a few years, and you'll have a rough year. The last 4 or 5 years, I haven't been down there as much doing other projects. So somebody like Caitlin could probably speak a little more to the last few years.
Well, we are about to get to another guest, which is who Paul has just been referencing, but you have a chance to get in here too. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to talk to us about Westport. So I do want to get another guest in on this, a Westport business owner who's been on the scene for a long time. Her business is on the newer side. Caitlin Corcoran is with us from Sava. That's a champagne bar just a block or so from McCoy's. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Gina.
Do you think that the Westport your business exists in today is in some way different from the Westport that you kind of came up in?
So my background is I am a Kansas City kid, like not from the suburbs, grew up in Midtown. So I have very fond memories of growing up in Westport. I went to book club at Reading Reptile. I danced at Westport Ballet. I went to Murray's for ice cream. Like, Westport is where I really like grew up and fell in love with Kansas City. And so I was really excited to be part of this new change when I worked at Port Fonda. We were kind of the first new chef-driven concepts that had come back to Westport. It wasn't a bar. It was a little bit fresher food, a fresher concept, a little bit hipper. And instead of opening the Crossroads, we opened in Westport. And then Port Fonda happened, and then Julep and Sava opened about the same time. So I jokingly refer to our corner as like the grown-up area of Westport. It'd be really cool if Pot Pie and Blue Stem wanted to like move down and be by us. But for the most part, I think that what we were attracting was people that thought Westport was just a shot bar and people that were just going to like get blackout drunk. And it was like, no, you can have a really elevated dining experience with beautiful craft cocktails and great wine and still be in Westport. And then later, if your friends want to get real wild, you can walk down the street and do that, but you can start your night off with a great dinner.
Do you see it as kind of like there are stages of the night in Westport?
For sure, but I also do think that, like Paul was saying, it's cyclical. I mean, I do think that Westport has gone through so many changes. I mean, my mom and dad met in Westport. My mom was a bartender at the Classic Cup, which was where Sweet Siam is now. So, like, I know what her experience was being a bartender in Westport and hearing how it, you know, it started out being lots of great restaurants like the Super and the Prospect and those kind of places. And then the 80s kind of changed some of that dynamic, and the 90s and 2000s brought in a different crowd. But, you know, it's cyclical. Things like change. And I do think that the course of the evenings now for my business this past probably 6 months are different than they were when we first opened almost 5 years ago.
So talk to me about that. First of all, I mean, Sava has been open, you just said, almost 5 years. And at that point, you kind of referenced this, but it seems like Westport was maybe coming out of a little bit of a slump right then.
For sure. And I do think that the Crossroads had not blown up to the extent that it has now with the so many dining destinations. But I do think that for me, what's happening is we used to be busy the entire time we were open. We serve food and drinks from 4 p.m. to 1 a.m. every night we're open. And so we used to have a really great happy hour. We would sometimes get a lull for dinner because some people don't think of Sava as a restaurant. They think it was more of a bar. We have great food, though, so you should come eat with us. And then we would get a late night pop. And usually that late night business would be from service industry friends getting off work, knowing that they could come in, have a nice glass of wine, unwind from their day with a cheese board and pommes frites, and not have to like deal with like craziness. But now we're noticing that after 11 p.m., we don't have that same late night business. And so it's pretty much a ghost town from 11 till 1.
What accounts for that, do you think?
I mean, I think it's a lot. I think that a lot of the Sava clientele was not super on board or happy about the barricades and the privatization situation. I also think that around that same time, the Bank of America building, the construction started happening, and parking woes are real, unfortunately, in Kansas City. People aren't used to using mass transit to get places or ride-sharing apps, and so they do demand parking. And when you take away, like, 75 spots on top of doing something else that's polarizing, people might just, like, choose somewhere else to go. Because also the number of dining destinations and bars that have opened in Kansas City within the last 6 months alone is insane. It's huge, huge numbers, and the restaurant industry is hard, and thin margin lines. So it will be interesting to see how some of that shakes out the next couple of years. But Westport's not the only game in town anymore. You know, there's Crossroads, there's Westport, or there's Power and Light, there's River Market, there's Plaza, there's Waldo, there's people that don't want to drive into the city anymore, and there's things happening way out in the suburbs. So I think that for a long time, Westport was the only entertainment district, and now it's not.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we are talking about change in Westport as a longtime business there, McCoy's Public House, gets ready to close. So now people who follow development trends are probably following exactly what Caitlin's describing right now, that there's this experiment going on with privatization. Security checkpoints are a part of that. Historic buildings are getting knocked down. Parking's getting rejiggered. Going forward, the streetcar's expansion plan was approved. So the streetcar will be going into East Westport. A lot is changing. And KCUR's Andrea Tudhope is going to explain that a little bit. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Gina.
So first of all, explain the deal with privatization.
Yeah, so basically we had seen a couple of sort of high-profile gun violence incidents in Westport. Obviously, we've seen violent crime and gun-related homicides on the rise in recent years, but when it happens in a highly concentrated area, it gets a lot more attention. So one of those incidents was there was a Lee Summit police officer off duty. His name was Thomas Orr. He was at a patio party at Californo's. He was shot and killed, and that was one of those high-profile incidents. So from that, you know, a lot of business owners started expressing concern about their patrons being afraid to come And I think a lot of people felt that they had no other choice but to do something about it. And that's how, I think that's really how privatization came up. So basically that was an effort to barricade the area and install metal detectors so that guns would no longer be allowed in the
privatization
district.
Meaning this is no longer just a public place that anyone has the right to stroll onto as they would, you know, the street outside right. our office, for example.
Right, right. It definitely makes it more difficult to get in, and there are rules that you have to follow to get in. You know, there was a... So basically, council passed this last December, and the metal detectors and barricades didn't go up until about August. And I was there the first or second night that they had installed them, and it was fascinating, you know? I mean, there were long lines at each opening. There was a long line at Mills Street and Westport Road that wrapped all the way around. That's over by Off Key and kind of like leading to that parking garage over there. There was a line the whole time I was there. So basically that came as a result of those incidents of violence. So it's kind of like privatization as a public safety alternative for the owners in the area.
And then there are also concerns around that about who does and doesn't feel safe in Westport as a result of the change.
Right. So there was a lot of opposition to privatization as well. And I should say not all of the owners in the area were on board. There were concerns about the potential for racial profiling. There's been a lot of great reporting by Aaron Randall at the Kansas City Star about racism in the district anyway, and whether everyone feels welcome there or not. And there were a lot of concerns that people who would be wanded and heavily screened to get in, that they might be unfairly treated if they're, you know, not white. And I think part of the compromise there that the city made was bringing on civil observers to make sure, so from Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, to make sure that everyone was being treated fairly at those screening points. And, you know, I think it will take time to see whether that's working or not, but it has been interesting to see that those long lines might be deterring people from coming, that, you know, I don't know yet if people feel comfortable with that. And I think, you know, time will tell on that for sure.
And then what's the deal with the historic buildings in the neighborhood and parking?
Yeah, so Westport made a list of, like, most endangered places recently from historic Kansas City. The Bank of America building was torn down. It was this beautiful old brick building, and I think it's been razed for a new massive apartment building. With it went that, like, huge parking lot, sort of unofficial parking lot in Westport. what was that, like 50 slots that are gone now? That's like, that's a lot. That was kind of one of the main parking areas over there. And we're just not really a city that has a lot of pedestrian traffic. You know, people don't really, like, walk that much, and they don't take ride-sharing opportunities like Caitlin was mentioning. So
could they learn?
I really think so. I think there's potential for that. But that is a big issue, I think, you know.
That affects Westport.
For sure.
Okay, we're going to get some response to that. But I want to go ahead and bring in our callers, because we have lots of people who want to share memories of McCoy's and lots of people who have insights into what they see as change in Westport. So I want to start with some McCoy's memories from Sean, calling us appropriately from Westport. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to share?
Well, a couple of things. We moved here from Atlanta in 2012, and we touched down in Kansas City in January, and there's a little bit of snow on the ground, cold weather, and dismal out, and staying at a hotel, and, like, Kansas City's not for us. Don't want to move here. And concierge at the hotel recommend we walk up to McCoy's. And, you know, good food, you know, they make their own beer. Like, sure, that sounds wonderful. Walk over there. Brave the cold, and here again from Atlanta, and I braved the cold and go over to McCoy's, and it was one of the best experiences, you know, that we could have had, because it set the tone for us moving to Kansas City. And, you know, fast forward a little bit, and we end up buying a home in the Roanoke neighborhood, which is, you know, walking distance to McCoy's Foundry, when Foundry existed. And, you know, so my wife and I came down to Westport all the time, just walk down. And, you know, fast forward another year or two, and all of a sudden we have some kids. We have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old now. And McCoy's, and quite frankly, the whole Pure KC group, has done a wonderful job on making restaurants in the Westport area that you can bring your kids to early in the afternoon or early in the evening. Staff is wonderful and, you know, good food options.
You know, what I'm hearing here from you, Sean, is that this has been a place that you've been able to sort of like grow up with, that it had something for you. It has had something for you at different stages of your life. So it wasn't like, well, my Westport days are over.
Well, absolutely. And I've actually entertained a little fantasy in my mind. You know, my oldest son, Andrew, is like, you know, 10 years from now, you know, when he is, you know, going out on his own, he'll be able to stop in McCoy's and some of the staff will, you know, still be there and say, hey, we remember seeing you when you were one, when you were two, you were learning to walk.
Aww.
And, but all of a sudden McCoy's is to be no more, which is, you know, real shame.
Well, that was a real tribute. But, thank you, Sean. I want to let Paul respond to this. Families, like, we don't think of the Westport regular as a family. That's not like the stereotype of the Westport regular.
Yeah, that was a big deal when we opened. Of course, the company has always felt that way, that they wanted to provide family friendly restaurants. But when we opened and people were coming in there, they were shocked to see we had boosters and high chairs and a kids menu and crayons. It just wasn't what they expected in Westport. And I think, you know, the neighborhoods around there were desperately starving for something that they could walk to and bring their families to in the afternoon and early dinner.
Let's talk to Timothy calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Tim.
Hello?
Hello. What do you want to share?
Oh, hey, Gina. How are you? Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tim.
I'm calling because I just wanted to kind of shout out and highlight how the owners had personally helped me out. I was a assistant chef at McCoy's for three years and then a sous chef over at Beer Kitchen for a little while. And yeah, Mark and James, really, they went out of their way to get my company, Kansas City Canning Company, off the ground. Early on when we needed a commercial kitchen, they let me use the McCoy's restaurant overnight. They were able to give me insight into what it takes to run a successful business. And even after that, after I had left the company, they put me in touch with the Tomstown Distillery to help their culinary program, which was unnecessary but very welcome at the time. And I'm just one of many who, you know, if you think about Keith and Rich over at Brewery Imperial, and, you know, McCoy's is absolutely an institution, and I think that their influence is felt in a lot of ways outside of what you would normally think about.
Well, thanks. Thanks for calling. And so, Paul, talk to me about that piece of it, this, like, training ground and for the Kansas City food scene more broadly.
Yeah, very true. Mark and James have been great with that. And that was a great story, Tim, by the way. They've been great about their training and how they take care of people and how they really bring them into their fold and teach them the business. You know, as he mentioned that Keith Thompson over at Brewery Imperial was our brewer for 18 years and Rich Kazajanski was a bartender there for about 10 years and they opened Brewery Imperial. And you look at Port Fondo where you have Patrick Ryan, the chef owner, and you have Jamie Davila, the general manager part owner. They were a line cook and a server for us at McCoy's when we opened. And, you know, right now, if you go online and just start reading stories, you have story after story about how they helped people either start their own business or just move forward in life, whether it's college or whatever.
Let's talk to Mike calling us from Roland Park. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You wanted to talk to us about Westport.
Yeah, we are. It's just interesting to hear this conversation with Massage, and I don't mean to be a downer here, but it's just hilarious to hear you all talking with such nostalgia about a place that was only 20 years old. I mean, I'm looking at it from a perspective of a person that's almost 70. And, you know, I miss places like the Prospect and the Greek Islands restaurant, you know, long before McCoy's was there. And it sounds like I'm really missed something by not going to McCoy's, and unfortunately we'll never be able to experience it. And so I appreciate those that do experience it. But to hear the perspective that, you know, this is a loss of an institution, I don't know, it's just hilarious for me.
Well, you know, and that's interesting, Mike, because maybe, you know, you're talking about that you wish you had given McCoy's a chance, but that you were maybe busy bemoaning the loss of your own institutions from another era in Westport, and maybe that's sort of a good lesson for all of us to just also keep an open mind going forward.
And part of it is, and this may be an unfortunate perspective, but my perspective of McCoy's, and I probably should have gone in and found out that my perspective was wrong, my perspective is that it was a bar, and I don't drink, really, and neither does my wife. And so, you know, going to a place that's a bar was not something that was terribly appealing. And that, again, that's probably my loss, and I understand that they were more than that.
Well, Mike,
but,
thank you for this call. I'm going to go ahead and talk about this piece of it, which is that Westport, that people who are a part of the McCoy scene, that there is like this whole story of Westport that predates it. Caitlin has alluded to it, that she grew up within that. I kind of grew up within it too. And Caitlin, you rattled off the names of a bunch of places that defined like the 70s and 80s Westport mm-hmm. experience. Can you talk about a couple of those that just really have a soft spot in your heart, and also maybe harken back to a pre-McCoy's Westport that is now gone?
Well, I think that the original Classic Cup location and that business model is something that I've always been super attracted to. It was a little restaurant, but you could also buy charcuterie and wine to go. And then next door, they had a classical music store with like kind of like funny little like artsy gifts. Like the fact that like Westport could support a classical music only record store was amazing to me. But I just think that that idea was so great. And it was also, it encouraged people in the community to come and like go into your establishment, but then take a little bit of it home and like have their own dinner party. But you were providing that service. And unfortunately, I never got to attend or dine at the Prospect, but I met Bonnie Winston later in life. She was a really great regular at Savah before she passed away 2 years ago. But the fact that that was a woman-owned restaurant in the mid to late 70s, I thought was amazing. Like, that's, she was so inspiring that she had, like, the chutzpah to, like, do that and make it work. And also, I can't imagine what that patio would be like if it wasn't the current the current restaurant that it is now, because it is a really awesome patio.
Caitlin, you've talked about when you opened Savah and mm-hmm. when you chose Westport as the location. Would you still, if you were opening your business today, would you open it there?
I mean, to be honest, I don't think so. I mean, I live downtown. I really like being downtown. I think that I probably would have looked at the River Market harder.
Can you explain that a little more?
I just feel like it's, I don't know. I like the synergy that's happening in the River Market. I like the farmers market on Saturday mornings. I like the streetcar. I like that energy. And honestly, I like the energy that you can start in the River Market and then take a couple streetcar stops for free, if you didn't know that, and get off and go to another bar. And then you can get back on the streetcar and go down a little bit further to the crossroads. And so the idea that like you don't have to be contained to just one area for the night is really appealing. I mean, that's why I was a big advocate, and I'm a huge supporter of the streetcar, and I'm very excited about the expansion. And I'm interested to see what happens with that development in Eastport.
Eastport, is that the nickname for the eastern part of Westport?
Yeah.
I haven't heard that before. Paul, do you think that McCoy's represents a Westport of a certain time, like a time that's gone by at this point? Or do you think someone else is going to come along, take up that mantle? Westport will still be Westport. What do you think?
I think, I'm hoping something great goes in there. I'm hoping something that we all enjoy going to and is an anchor like McCoy's has been. But yeah, as we said earlier, things are a little bit cyclical. It's funny to think back to right after we opened, Broadway Roastery and Broadway Cafe opened not long afterwards. Well, a few years later, right on the corner next to Broadway Cafe, a Starbucks came in. And the town was in an uproar about that. All of Westport, nobody wanted to support it. Starbucks normally picks a great location, and they normally succeed very, very well. This thing lasted less than a year and a half, and Westport took care of considering what is its own. And it's strange to see now that you're getting a lot more corporate entities in there. And so, you know, we're hoping this corner stays local and can keep the vibe we've had for a long time.
Paul Genez, thank you.
Thank you.
Caitlin Corcoran of Sava, KCUR's Andrea Tudhope, thank you both too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, a new kind of business in our area and maybe a new kind of capitalism? Stay tuned to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're talking about a new trend in business that does not sound very businessy. Retail establishments that exist to raise money not for the business owners, but for social causes. They've been popping up around town, and we're curious about them. So let's start by hearing about a couple of local businesses trying out this kinder, gentler version of capitalism, and then we will see how that fits into a national trend. Tara Stuckey is with us from Cause Coffee in DeSoto, where, according to their website, they send their profits to developing nations for education, clean water wells, food and disaster relief crisis, orphan care. The list goes on. Hi, Tara.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me on the show.
So the question on most people's mind when they hear about a business like yours is, how does that work? I mean, employees need to eat, rent needs to be paid. How are you setting this all up?
Well, you know, I'm in kind of a unique situation. I had just this vision of this coffee shop, and in my mind, I had it all planned, and I really thought that it would work. And so far, it's been successful beyond what I imagined. You know, I'm gifted a building that is rent-free, so that obviously helps. I do not have the overhead in my situation of the rent of a building. But also, other than myself and a few other people who work a lot of hours, and that is by our choice, most of the volunteers just work a couple hours a week or a few hours a month. So it's no different than them going to serve, say, at a homeless shelter. I mean, it does not give very much up of their time. But because I do not have the salaries going out from employees, and we're able to give so much back what would have been, you know, people's paychecks.
Tell me the story of how this came about, where you even got the idea to do this.
You know, I didn't get the idea from any place. I'm not saying that there's not another coffee shop like that out there, but it just kind of was born in my head and my heart. Years ago, I was trained as a craft barista at a local Kansas City coffee shop. And I just fell in love with coffee, but I also fell in love with the atmosphere of a coffee shop, just the camaraderie of the people and just the community that it represented. And I just dreamed of opening my own coffee shop one day. And I had kind of a bigger dream of raising a family. So I've been doing that the last 20 years and raising kids. And I knew that one day I would open a shop. And about 5 years ago, I started dreaming about what a nonprofit coffee shop would look like. I've traveled to other countries, and two of my children are adopted internationally. And I've just seen firsthand the needs in our own community, but especially in the world globally. And I just started thinking, you know, what could a coffee shop do? And so I started really defining what that nonprofit coffee shop would look like to me. And, you know, I sought a lot of advice from other people, and I was met with some people who even thought that my idea was crazy. But I really, really felt that it would work because I felt like there was amazing people who would get on my team and would catch my vision. And that's what's happened. So I just thought, what if a, you know, small coffee shop that opened its doors for the single purpose of giving help and hope to the community and to the world, you know, what could happen? What kind of things could we do, and how many lives could we change? And so about 9 months after I seriously started planning, Cause Coffee opened its doors, and now we've been open for about 9 months.
Open 9 months, and I hate to sound crass when you sound so idealistic, but about how much money have you been able to send off to support these causes?
You know, there's been thousands of dollars a month. It varies from month to month because it's after our expenses. So, you know, we have to purchase all of our coffee, our tea, our food items. You know, we provide breakfast and lunch on our menu. So we obviously have a lot of overhead and expenses. We had to pay for all of our equipment. But, you know, we were able to purchase a clean water well in Uganda this summer. We were able to take care of teacher salaries and a whole bunch of needs for a school, some repairs for their school and school books for a school in Nicaragua. And then we were able to take care of a whole bunch of medical needs for an orphanage in Haiti, but then also provide Christmas for all of the orphans. And then right now we're providing Christmas for some local families in our community that don't have money for that.
Well, Tara, hang on with me. I want to talk now with Crystal Pena. She's here from a business called Do Good KC. And Crystal, what is your business?
So Do Good Co. is a nonprofit retail store. We're on West 39th Street, 39th and Terrace. And we are We have primarily donated merchandise, so we have a low cost of goods, and that's what allows us to resell our products, and we have a greater profit margin. I was listening to Tara speak about, you know, all the expenses that she incurs with purchasing products, and we're lucky enough that most of our items are donated to us, and so we're able to donate a large portion of our proceeds back to two local nonprofits, Kids TLC, which is a healing community for children, and then KC Pet Project, which is Kansas City's largest no-kill shelter.
So what was your story that led you to this place? Were you kind of like researching this movement, or was this more kind of along the lines of what happened to Tara, just an idea that came to your head that happened to also be coming into a lot of other people's heads?
Yeah, I love that this idea is catching on, and it's so cool to hear about the way other people are executing it. Actually, I can't take credit for this idea. I am lucky enough that this opportunity fell into my lap last year. There's a woman that I've worked with on fundraisers over the years, Janet Curran. She has been kind of stewing this idea for years. She just knew that there was another opportunity. There's another way to approach retail. And she's been thinking about how to make this work. She wanted to give back to these two organizations that mean so much to her. She's always been very interested in children's health and animal welfare. So she came up with the idea over the last few years. She's been communicating with her friends and peers and community to start kind of stockpiling, if you will, merchandise for the opening of this store. So she called me in after she had come up with the idea and asked if I would run the store. She knew that my background was in retail and I'd always wanted to do something that felt like it mattered. So this was just the most perfect opportunity for me. And I was just grateful that she called me on board so early.
So what kind of stuff do you sell there? It's a social impact lifestyle store.
Exactly. So we started out with just women's apparel and furniture and home furnishings, and we've been able to expand into men's and children's apparel as well. And during the month of December, we pull in 10 other vendors that are other socially minded and mission-based companies. So we've got a variety of other products. We have some body care. We have some children's toys and gifts and things like that. It's part of our Gifts That Give market. But typically, we carry men's, women's, and children's apparel and home furnishings.
So do you think that people come into the store because of the social mission, or is it more like there's a candle that I want, or there's a shirt that would be nice on my husband, or whatever?
Yeah, it's really interesting. That's something that we always want to find out when people come in. So we always ask people what brings them in, because I'm just curious, did you find us on Instagram, or did your friend tell you about it, or did you just walk by and see the window? And it's everything. People walk by, they don't always know what the store is. So sometimes they're just curious, what does Do Good Co. mean? We have a beautiful mural that was painted by a local artist on the outside of our building, John Rubb. And so a lot of people come in because they either recognize his work or they want to find out more about who did it. A lot of people have heard about it from their friends and family. There's a lot of different reasons that bring us in, but we just make sure everybody understands the mission when they get there.
Well, in just a minute, a journalist who has followed this trend of nonprofit retail is going to weigh in. What is it all about and can it work? That's just around the corner. So stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're talking about food and retail businesses staffed in many cases with volunteers, with proceeds going to social causes, not business growth or personal profit. We've been talking with the owners of Cause Coffee in DeSoto and Do Good Co. here in town. They both operate along those lines. Ben Painter joins us now. He's a senior writer for Fast Company magazine, and he wrote about what he called a movement, philanthropic enterprise. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
It's good to talk to you. What is the model here? Because this is not actually nonprofit retail. It's for-profit businesses giving away money.
Yeah. So philanthropic enterprise sort of is a great way to address some of the concerns with what might be a nonprofit retail model. Basically, you know, the idea is nonprofit retail models are very challenging. You do have to rely on sort of volunteers or, you know, some way that lowers overhead in order to make those businesses run, donated, you know, shop space or things like that. You're often sort of subject to donations or grants to keep those models running. What a philanthropic enterprise does is different. It's this sort of idea of conscious capitalism, which is that you will create a company that will work to sort of pay its employees at, you know, fair wages, and then beyond that, operate as leanly as possible to really channel any of the profits coming in back out to other companies. I'm sorry, not other companies, other causes. And one of the interesting things about giving money away to those causes is, you know, you're able to sort of come up with a corporate mission, but you're also subject to competing head to head with other companies, which really means that, you know, it's the type of product and the quality of product or service that you're providing that ultimately depends whether or not you're winning out, versus, you know, some of these other companies that you're talking about here today. Seem like they may have play more of a community sort of unification aspect too, that you know, not every social enterprise necessarily has.
You know, I'm curious about what about this caught your attention on the national scale. Can you give some examples of what you were seeing pop up that might have felt new to you?
Yeah, I mean, so on the for-profit for charity side, the classic example, which was what caught my attention and caused me to write about it in the first place, was that Newman's Own, which is the classic salad dressing maker, they give all their profits to charity. I think they've raised, it's just hundreds of millions since the 80s that they've given away. I think it's 500 million. But they were in a bit of a bind because they grew so big that they were giving their money to the Newman's Own Foundation, they grew so big that they wanted their idea to live on after Paul Newman's death. And in order to do that, they founded the Newman's Own Foundation. Once Paul Newman passed away, they were in a unique position of basically having some outdated business taxes being applied to that foundation. And then there were sort of questions on, you know, whether or not they could make as much impact as they used to make. And so that there was a law called the Philanthropic Enterprise Act that was just passed. And that the idea with that law was that you could allow foundations like Newman's Own to continue to operate, and give money back to charities in the way that they can and should work. But then beyond that, there's just been sort of, you know, it's been such a turbulent, last couple of years in the world. And there's a lot of different companies that are for-profit companies that sort of popped up around that. Newman's Own has been running a bit of an incubator for for-profit companies. So there's like companies like Fetch Eyewear in Portland, Oregon, that puts all their proceeds towards animal rescue. There's a brewery in Minneapolis.
Like designer glasses that help you save puppies.
Yes, exactly. And or a brewery that sort of gives its own money to a community fund that helps feed the hungry. Or there's even sort of management tech and consulting firms that, you know, fund health clinics or programs addressing children's poverty. And those are interesting models because at least among some of them, as you build those companies up in value, the owners may eventually want to sell. And in some cases, they've given the equity of the company to charities or community funds too. So when they do sell, they can basically endow those other funds with enough money to sort of keep doing good work in perpetuity.
I mean, you've mentioned that Newman's Own has been around for a while, but what do you think accounts for all these other businesses, both locally in Kansas City, and then it sounds like nationally popping up? You referenced the turbulence of the last couple of years. Do you think that that's what it's about, or is it something else?
I think there's a lot of change that needs to be made in the world and not enough people doing it. And so the idea of business, any business, whether it's nonprofit or for-profit, becoming a force for good, I think is really, really powerful. I think that the new, you know, sort of generation of millennials, I mean, today's shoppers are very value oriented with their brands and their goods and their services. And so if you're not a company with a specific sort of designated mission to telegraph that very heavily, you're just a you're just another product maker. And that mission sort of, you know, helps set a lot of these companies apart. You know, and what does a company need to do ultimately? I mean, as far as the ideology of some of these founders, you know, when you're running a healthy company, you provide a service in creating jobs. So that's, you know, one benefit, especially if you're paying fair and decent wages. But, you know, beyond that, I think a lot of the owners of these companies don't need to or want to get totally rich. They just want to provide, you know, stable services and products for their community and build a community.
Well, I'm interested in hearing from one of our guests about that. But is there also, when you talk about the way that millennials shop, that they shop in a way that they want there to be some other, like, benefit to society, is that also a different formula for giving, where you're also going to walk away with a product?
Yeah, you know, yes and no. I mean, that's kind of a tough thing. I mean, that's sort of ultimately one of the questions of a lot of these companies is, like, people I think want an additional benefit when they go to choose, you know, to patronize any of these companies. The other question, of course, is, you know, if you want to give money to charity, how do you do it cost efficiently? And the easiest, most cost efficient way is to just donate your money directly to a charity that you choose, that you've vetted, so you understand, you know, sort of what the value is per dollar you give to that charity, what will go into program, you know, program efforts to help people. And, you know, the problem is that there's been sort of a middle class drop off in who's actually giving to charity these days. The people who are giving directly to charity are predominantly sort of the super wealthy. And part of that's just because, you know, wages haven't increased for middle class Americans for so long. But, you know, when people stop volunteering or stop interacting with different charities on a community level, there's a lot that gets lost. And I think these nonprofit retail spaces, in a way, provide a lot of that sort of community building and community benefit that, you know, allow people to sort of re-engage with nonprofits. The question is, you know, for people going in there, would they be spending that money elsewhere on something different that didn't have a social benefit?
Like you're going to buy the glasses anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you're going to buy the glasses anyway, that's great. If you're going to buy the cup of coffee anyway, you know, that's great. Why not have it go to a social cause? I think the onus is on the companies that have been formed to really be clear and telegraph where the money is going and what the cost efficiency per dollar spent is, so that they can continue to build trust with their customers.
Tara Stuckey, I want to bring you back on to talk about the community unification thing that Ben mentioned, that's part of sort of what a lot of these businesses are interested in. Tell me more about the community and how the community that gathers at your coffee shop, Cause Coffee in DeSoto.
You know, that is such an interesting element. You know, this vision that I had for this coffee shop primarily at the beginning was about globally impacting lives and doing stuff for people like the homeless in our community, which we give all of our pastries back to in the Kansas City area. But I definitely wanted to create a gathering spot for people in the local DeSoto, Kansas area, but also the surrounding communities like Lawrence, Kansas, and people come from all over Kansas City. Honestly, I was not prepared for the amazing love that the community has shown us for doing that. It has definitely become a gathering spot. People are calling it their own, whether they're meeting a friend, a family member, a, you know, business meeting, or maybe they're coming to just work on their laptop or read a book. It's become just a very special spot, and I'm seeing it. I know this is going to sound crazy, but almost like change lives. I mean, people are telling me stories every week about how Cause Coffee is making a difference in their life because of that aspect of it. It's also creating a spot for the, like, local high school kids to come after school and gather where they can get a healthy snack. And, you know, the parents know where they are. And parents have expressed to me their extreme appreciation for giving their kids a place to hang out that's a safe environment.
Well, Tara, thank you. You know, before we go, Ben, I just wonder if you can give one pointer as far as, like, thing that works, thing that doesn't work in your research so far.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think that the most important thing is that you have a product that people want. I mean, without a great product, all of the idealism is going to sort of go by the wayside, because that's what you're offering people is, you know, a way to sort of, you know, be idealistic and provide a social benefit to wherever the, you know, whatever the cause may be.
Basically, the same as would be the advice across the board. Have something people want. Ben Painter, we're going to have to end it there. Yep. Thank you for joining us from Fast Company Magazine.
Thank you.
And Tara Stuckey of Cause Coffee, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're also here with Crystal Pena of Do Good Co. Crystal, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's show. Tomorrow, there's a part of the local story behind Mickey Mouse you haven't heard before, and it's captured in a new book called A Mouse Divided. We'll talk about it tomorrow. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.